welcome to another episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I am your host, Emma Gunn Wardner, and in this episode, I am joined by Alison Hogg, MBE, who is the founder and CEO of beauty brand Vita Liberata. Now, I feel as though I need to give you context and a background about Alison, because what you are about to hear is not a brand story. Believe it or not, this podcast, I hit record pretty much a few minutes after Alison and I met for the first time, which is bizarre. I would have thought we would have met before, despite obviously working in the same industry for many years. Our paths just hadn't crossed. And weirdly, it's so weird how these things happen, isn't it? Weirdly, I was having a conversation with my dear, dear friend Mary Kate the other day about how bizarre it was that I hadn't met somebody, not Alison in this case, by the way, how I hadn't met somebody who I have a lot of mutual friends with. And we were talking about it, and she was saying maybe it's just not the right time, or maybe you're not meant to meet, that kind of thing. Just sort of saying, yeah, it is weird, but maybe you're not meant to, kind of thing. And then in a completely different set of conversations, I would say in the space of around a month, I think about six really good friends, apropos of absolutely nothing, said, have you had Alison Hogg on your podcast yet? And of course I said no. And they all gave me that look as if to say, Ems, this needs to be your priority. Get the heck out of here and go and email some people or make some calls. And so I did. And within a few days, I had this booked and in the diary. Yes, she founded and is the CEO of Vita Liberata. And regular listeners will know that I'm a big fan of their body blur. I think it's genuinely one of the best topical products ever made. But every single person who said I needed to podcast with Alison said it not just because of her brand and her background in beauty, but because she's so inspiring. All of them were like, dude, you're going to be eating out of her hands. She is amazing. Just you wait. So I booked this in and I thought, okay, I'll be the judge of that. And look, it's not for me to influence how you interpret the contents of this show, but I can tell you about my personal experience in the room with Alison. I cried. I thought so many times how I was so glad I now had someone with her insight and attitude in my life. Because, side note, I got her number, and unless she blocks me, I'm making us friends. And with every golden nugget of insight she said, I felt such a sense of pride that I was going to be publishing them in her first ever podcast for you, my brilliant, beloved listeners. We talked for well over an hour, and had it not been for a flight that she had to catch, I think we could have easily talked for another three without a break. It was that good. She'll be coming back. I'll definitely be getting her back on the show. So I'm glad that we, as in you and I, you and my brilliant listeners, have got to know her so well in this episode. All the links to everything that we discuss, Vita Liberata, Alison, whatever else comes up, will be in the show notes, which you can find wherever you are streaming, downloading, or listening to this podcast. And I'd love your feedback, so email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. If you have any comments about the show, or if you prefer, you can DM me on social media. I'm at Emma Guns, which is E-M-M-A-G-U-N-S, on Instagram and Twitter, and obviously there's the private Facebook group where I'd love you to join. The link to join that will be in the show notes. It is closed, and I do try to get around to approving people as quickly as possible, so you shouldn't have too long of a wait. And if you're a regular listener and you don't never want to miss an episode, then please do, wherever you're listening to this, hit that subscribe button. And if it does give you an option to leave a 5-star review and write a little rating, I would be so blinking grateful if you would. That would just be amazing. It would help a podcast like mine stand out on massive podcast platforms. Right, I'm going to get to it, because now is the time. Oh, you're going to love this. I think you're going to love it. Here she is, making her debut, not only on The Emma Gunn Show, but as far as I'm aware, her podcast debut. Here she is, Alison Hogg, on The Emma Gunn Show. So, Alison Hogg, you join me, and I've already told you about this as you walked into the room, because I don't often share with people who I'm podcasting with, but I have a lot of buddies in the beauty industry, and a handful of them have called me today and basically said, tell her I say hi, I love her, she's amazing.
I'm like the best kept Irish secret. Who's Alison Hogg?
But there is so much adoration and respect for you. It's not just like a blind love. It's not like media darling love. It's proper admiration.
That just leaves me speechless and a bit teary.
I know. That's just really cruel of me, isn't it?
It's very hard to start a thing like that. That is really kind of you to say. That is really lovely. Do you know what that does for me on a daily basis? When I meet challenges every day, and you do, you know, my brother says being in business is like having a little guy on the desk with a bat, and every time that you think that you've done something well, the little guy on the desk with the bat goes, no, you haven't. Bang! And hits you in the other ear. And that's what business is like for all of those of you who want to go into business. So sometimes when you're in the trenches all the time on a constant basis, and working with a lot of men, you know, men like to point out flaws on a consistent basis. They're very, very good at that. Very, very good at going to the negative. Very, very good at finding what's the problem, you know. So to have some women say that is really lovely, actually. Yeah. It's lovely to hear.
Yeah, and like I said, it's not often that I share it. And as soon as I said, yeah, Alison Hogg's going to be on the show, it was just, right, ask her this. Tell her that. Does she remember me? Like, literally.
I remember you all.
And also, another reason is because I have pursued you relentlessly in the last couple of weeks is because you did a talk recently, and a friend of the show, Nadine Baggett, was there, and she called me and she said, you've got to get Alison on your show ASAP. So that's what intensified the pursuit. Yeah.
And you know, that was lovely, that event, because it I was able to talk to young women in an industry that I now inhabit, having only joined this industry when I was 40. So, you know, I was a very grown-up person by the time I entered beauty. And so to be able to pass on some experience to much younger women, you know, 25, 23, all very young girls, who are really looking for some direction and I think a bit of confidence building, a bit of someone saying, do you know what, it's okay, you can do whatever you want to do, and so long as you do it well and you give your whole self into it, then it's completely, you know, it's completely valid. And one girl, during that thing, one girl asked me, you know, how do I get people to take me seriously? I'm a blogger, I think she was an Instagrammer. I work really hard at this. I do earn money. I work all day, every day, 7 days a week at this, but everybody says I'm not really doing a job. And I think it's because I'm in beauty. And I said to her, but I think you're in the business of confidence, no? And wouldn't confidence be a good thing to be in? And by the way, if you're making money and you end up being able to buy your own home and pay for everything yourself, what's not good about that? You know, stop seeing yourself as others judge you.
Yes.
Be true to yourself. You know, it's awfully serious. You should stop this.
No, it's not serious. It's true. And it reminded me of people who follow me on Instagram will know that I've recently got a big piece of art that I've put up in my office. Actually, very much nicked the idea from our good friend Nadine. But I have a big blow-up picture, artist rendering of Beyonce from the Formation video where she goes, the best revenge is your papers. Yeah. Because it's just, not that I'm looking for revenge, but it's about keeping our eye on that prize of, well, why am I doing this? So someone likes my stuff, or so I put a roof over my head?
Exactly. And it could be both things. And that's perfectly valid too. Because, you know, the thing is that you don't come into this world with a free pass. Well, some people do. If you're the child of a billionaire, you probably come in with a free pass for the rest of your life. But for the rest of us, you know, the world doesn't owe you a thing, unfortunately. And while I totally am, you know, a liberal towards socialist, social liberalist, whatever it is, and I do think that we should support the less able people in society and so on, the truth is that for the majority of us, we need to put food on our own table. We need to work out how to do that. And that's okay. But, you know, it can be very, 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 very tough. It can be tough to get a job. It can be tough to start a business. Life is a bitch. And then you die. So you'd better have some fun along the way. Yeah. You really had better.
Yeah.
You really had better.
So there's lots of stuff in that. And I also instantly want to take you back to, right, you said you got into the business at the age of 40. But in and amongst that, I also wanted to unpick what you said about you might as well have some fun along the way.
Yeah.
And this idea that I've put things up on my social media before where I've said, you know, love what you do. And people say, that's fine for you to say, Emma, but you're doing it. I have bills to pay. I've got a really big mortgage and I have to go to the job that I absolutely loathe. And I just wondered what your opinion is of that idea of do what you love. Because it's easier said than done.
Okay, right. Well, so that is a bit of a euphemism. Do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
Mm.
Okay.
No.
If there's a person in this world, on this planet, who's doing that, oh, God bless them. That's wonderful. But I think that that's impossible. I think what you have to do is find within any activity that you have to, that you have to do, you have to find the place in you that respects what you're doing and know the reason that you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You may not love it. You may hate it. I have to tell you, sitting looking at spreadsheets is not my favorite thing in the world, by far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having to call someone out for a mistake that they've made is not my favorite thing to do. But those are all bits of the job that I do. But you have to find the reason for doing something. And everything is a choice. Everything is a choice. And you need to remember that. So if you're working, you're choosing to work because you want to earn the money in order to pay your bills. That's a perfectly valid choice. There is nothing wrong with that choice. Once you start to realize that, you can maybe lighten up on feeling guilty about doing a job that you hate and finding, therefore, some fun or life within that. Because, I mean, I know some businesses are really horrible. I know that. But you have to learn to not take it too seriously. I'm the kind of person, I take everything seriously. I am 100% in on everything.
Alison, you are talking to your mirror image.
Yes.
It's got me into so much trouble over
Absolutely.
The years.
I am all in. Yeah. I do not work for money, and I am all in on everything. And I didn't really realize that most until, until this last deal that we did, where we've merged with an American company. Now we're in big corporate, right? They deal in hundreds of mil. Like, it's big corporate. And I realized that I couldn't stop myself doing what I believed to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And that is difficult for someone who doesn't agree with me on what is right. And I don't mean that I don't want to be challenged. But if I really passionately believe that there is a right course and a wrong course, I am unable to take the wrong course.
Yep.
To a fault. But then that's to do with my value system, the way I was brought up, what I believe in, my core. And you cannot deny your core, I don't think. I think you have to go with your core. And perhaps the people who are unhappiest are the ones who are fighting their core. Their core tells them one thing, and their daily life demands of them something that is completely diametrically opposed.
Yep.
And if that is the case, that's an unhappy place to be. Go look for a new job.
I've been reading a book recently. It was a recommendation from Adam Reed, the hairdresser. I don't know if you know Adam. He's been on this show before. And it's called The Law of Attraction. And it talks about how negative emotion is when... is the feeling that you're... basically, you've got, like, your inner being. And it's when the two things aren't aligned. So if you get a feeling of anxiety or something, it's because you're in a situation that you know deep down is wrong for you. So get out. I'm oversimplifying the message. It's a book. Link will be in the show notes. So let's take it back. That's really interesting. Let's take it back to, you said you got into the industry at age 40. What was this journey?
You mean, what was the journey to 40, or what was the journey from 40 to here, or what was the bridge between the life before Vita and the Vita life?
All of them. The Vita Life is the name of your reality show, by the way.
The Vita Life.
The Vita Life with Alison Hogg. Absolutely. I'm commissioning it. I'm executive producer.
Oh, no problem.
What was it at age 40 you thought, I'm going to work with a beauty brand? I'm going to start a beauty brand.
Well, I didn't. Okay. So here's exactly what happened. So I'm standing at my kitchen. I'm doing a PhD in philosophy of psychology at the time,
Ooh. I have just finished working with Women's Coalition about 6 months before, about a year before that, in the Good Friday Agreement and all of that, and working in politics and the peace process in Northern mm-hmm. Ireland. Learned a huge amount about negotiation, as you can imagine. The Shinners on one side and the Unionists on the other, and neither of the two would talk to each other. They'd only talk to us. So we had to kind of be the brokers in the peace, you know.
And
it was a heavy time. It was incredibly interesting, but it was very, very, very intense and not something that could be sustained long term. Not with five kids, certainly. So anyway, I'm standing at the cooker, and I'm reading Carol Gilligan, who is a feminist author. I don't know if you know her, but she's a feminist author.
Making a note.
I'm trying to help my six-year-old, now face of our brand, actually. It's hilarious. she got longer. And with her homework, and trying to make the dinner. And I was making spaghetti bolognese. The spaghetti had turned into mush. The bolognese bit of the spaghetti had burnt. Carol Gilligan had been read the same page, the same paragraph, actually, six times, and I still had no idea what she was trying to say. And Caitlin was doing her homework on her own. Mm. And I thought, I am actually failing at everything is going wrong here. And I'm not doing anything right. I'm not doing anything even near right. I need to change something. Mm. To your point, I need to change something. Mm. And so, coming from a business family in concrete, by the way, nothing to do with beauty, in concrete and road building and all construction and all of that stuff, it didn't occur to me that this was a really stupid thing to say. Mm. But in my head, this is what I said. Perhaps business would be less difficult than doing a PhD, which only a PhD student would say. It's the only person on the planet who would not know the business is much more difficult. What was I thinking? What was I thinking? So I just had moved to airy fairyland. I worked in broadcasting. I had run a country house at a time. I had done my PhD my degree as a mature student. Had my babies in the middle. I'd worked in politics. I'd done all of these different things, and so being, you know, and I'm just that kind of person who goes, yeah, I can do that, you know. I blind spots, and this was the massive blind spot. So I thought that maybe going into business would eventually make us some money. I was living on like £200 a month, and you know, my husband was working as well, but like literally nothing. And so I was thinking maybe I could make a living. And maybe it would be easier than trying to absorb Carol Gilligan while cooking the dinner and not helping Caitlin with her homework. So that was the big road to Damascus moment. Mm-hmm. And I gave up my PhD and I decided to make skincare. My mother had psoriasis. Mm-hmm. She died when I was 23, but she had dreadful psoriasis, covered head to toe. And it was horrific. I mean, like literally covered in an armor of scales. Mm. It was awful and totally drove her mad. And so I thought maybe we could make skincare, or that would be interesting to make and develop. And I had no clue what I was saying. Like, I had no clue of the words coming out of my mouth or in my head. I didn't have a clue about anything. How hard could it be?
The bolognese broke you.
How hard can bolognese totally? It's got to be easier than making spaghetti bolognese. So, I found a chemist. I had been working on Sky Shopping, trying to bring in extra money. So I had done a little bit of sales for the first time in my life on Sky Shopping for multivitamin supplements. And so I thought, you know, I can sell those. And it's a good idea having lots of vitamins in one thing. Maybe it could have lots of benefits in one, way ahead of my time. Lots of benefits in one piece of skincare. Way ahead of your time is not good for business, by the way. Okay, don't be too far ahead. You can need to be ahead of the curve, but not so far ahead of the curve that nobody has a clue what you're doing, unless you can fund the education, which back then, of course,
could. Oh, interesting.
You know, that's a big insight. Yeah, big thing I learned. Don't get too far ahead of the curve. And I do tend to think very far ahead of the curve, and I have to shut myself up. Zip.
So big ideas, maybe plot a few steps back in order to...
Absolutely. Oh, okay. Very important. Very important. Let the big guys educate for you if you're very, very tiny. Let them educate the idea, because education is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Letting the public know of something new and making them understand what that something new is and why they would want it and why it's good for them. This is tremendous if you can do it as a larger company, but as a startup, you need an awful lot of money to teach people about this new thing. Very difficult. Anyway, so that was my big concept, and it all sounded good in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I borrowed some money from the family, from my dad, and I bought some product, and we started. And it was awful, and it was ugly, and I had all this product. Nobody wanted to buy it from me. It hadn't occurred to me, like, where am I going to sell it? Mm-hmm. I thought I'd sell it on Sky Shopping, and that didn't work because everything was wrong. Everything was wrong. The product was great, but everything else was just disaster.
How did you educate yourself about what would work? Like, did you have a baseline knowledge anyway about active ingredients and
When I was doing my PhD, I was doing a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And so although it was research in philosophy of psychology, okay, fair enough, it was still the discipline of research. So
right.
I had a huge understanding of the discipline it would take to learn about the ingredients, to learn about what we would need, to learn about what should be put together.
Mm.
And then the key thing is to get a great chemist who can do all who can do all the chemistry bit.
Yeah.
But if you're thinking along the lines of let's make it moisturized, but let's also make it firm, and let's make it and let's feed and let's make sure there's lots of vitamins in there and you know, all of this stuff. It was amazing skincare. As I say, just in very, very ugly bottles. So how I educated myself was I went and stood in Castle Court in Belfast, which is a shopping centre. It was the only shopping centre in the middle of Belfast at the time. This was in 2003. And I stood there for like 6 months, day and night. I got spat at by the druggies over the balcony.
Oh, Christ.
And people kept stealing my product, the druggies, to sell it on, you know. And and at one point, I remember on Patrick's Day, at one point, these boys, I had my stand out, and it was Patrick's Day, so Colin was collecting kids from school and doing all these different things, and the kids had all come to see me because they had a half day off, so they'd all come to see me in Castle Court because I was standing with my stand. You know, being very conscientious, and I'd spent money, a little bit of money that I'd made in Castle Court, I'd spent it on these big banners behind me, and I was so proud of these big banners, and some little fecker, that's an Irish word, by the way, okay, it's not a swear.
No, it's fine, swearing is fine.
Some little fecker came along, this group of boys, and he knocked down, he couldn't just resist it, he knocked down one of my very expensive to me, probably cost me like 100 quid, but anyway, very expensive banners that he knocked over. And what he hadn't reckoned on was that this really tall woman, 40 plus, had also been a runner for Ireland. Well, by God, I caught the boy. They ran down and I ran after him. I just saw blind. I was so furious. Straight after him, and I caught him. But well, then
what do you do with him?
Well, exactly. Now I had him. What was I going to do? I dragged him, and I just held him, and he was looking at me. He was so terrified. And then somebody went and got security, and the security guy came, and I said, "No, what am I going to do with him? He's just knocked down my stand. He's done." He let him go. I was like, "You won't." And I was still holding on to him. Like, for anybody who doesn't know, I'm standing here with my hand grasped, showing how I was still holding on to his jumper. And I had to let him go. I was like, okay, there's something really wrong in this. Like, that's really wrong. But anyway, I did.
For a moment, I thought you were going to say, and he's now my financial director.
No.
That was going to be a beautiful story.
No. He has seen me probably several times in Belfast. I'm like, that's that woman who ran after me. Avoid her. I couldn't do that now. 15 years later of corporate and business life, and I'm very unfit. But back then, I was able to
move.
I was able to move, yes, and I caught him. Yeah.
So you were doing that Castle Court. I love the fact you don't call him St. Patrick.
Just Patrick.
Patrick's Day. Just informal.
No, that's the Irish call it Paddy's Day.
Of course.
Everybody else calls it St. Patrick.
St. Patrick's Day, yes.
He's Irish, sure. He doesn't need the formality.
Exactly, that's what I enjoyed about that moment. So what was the next step after that, after the sprint through the shopping centre?
So by the end of that stint of about 6 months, or maybe a little bit more, what I had learned was that, and that I was being, well, now I know, looking back, I was being very millennial about it. Okay.
So meaning
that I was thinking only about the gloop inside and how important that was. And the packaging I was keeping, to keep the price down, I was keeping the packaging very minimalist, very simple, very pared back, and not spending a lot on that, so that I could get a lot of gloop in a bottle, and the best value for money, and the best kind of gloop that I could possibly make, at a price that people could afford. That's very millennial about it, okay? It's, you know, it's very Presbyterian, if you like, you know, which is my background. I'm not religious, but my background is Presbyterian. Anybody who's Presbyterian will know exactly what that means. It means guilt. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots and lots and lots of guilt. Catholics think they're guilty, but they're not. Mm-hmm. They don't understand, because they get to get absolved from it. The Presbyterians take it to their grave. There's no absolution for Presbyterians. Just, you're born guilty and you stay guilty and just get guiltier as you go through your life. So I realised I'm going to have to make this a lot prettier. Mm-hmm. And I haven't made any money yet at all. And I'm getting terribly broke, and I'm going to need more money to make this prettier. And so I rang my dad, who at that point was my only source of income, really. And I said, so, Dad, the thing I've learned is that... And I was walking through Gatwick Airport, and I was very stressed to tell him this. I was like, this, all that stuff we spent money on, that's not going to work. So I'm going to have to make it all again, but make it in different packaging and make it look a lot prettier. And that's going to be really expensive. And I think we should just, like, stop now, because otherwise... we're going to throw good money after bad. And I was walking through Gatwick Airport, and I had two phones, one for work and one for personal. I don't know why I had two phones at that time. Actually, when I think about it,
it was 15
any sense.
Years ago. It makes sense.
Yeah, it made sense then. I have two phones now, but now I, you know, now it's for different reasons. But back then, I don't know why. Anyway, so I had my sister on one line, one phone, and my dad on the other, while walking through Gatwick Airport. My sister was saying, give it up, Alison, give it up and just live a life. You don't have to live this life. You don't have to be this stressed. It's very, very stressed about things. It's very stressed about money. You don't have to, you know, just move along. It's fine. You can do lots of different things. You've done lots of different things. You can do lots of different things more. It's okay. She was saying on this ear, on my right ear, on my left ear, I remember it so well, on my left ear, my dad said, under no circumstances will you stop. You're this far in, you will make it work. And I was like, but nothing. Right, how much do you need? And it was like, not very much money. But it was, to me, it was an enormous thing to think, I'm going to throw all this away, all this product, which we ended up giving away to some very lucky people, and start again, really? And that was the first of many starts again. You know, that wasn't the end of it. That was just the beginning of learning that I knew absolutely nothing about anything, and I was going to have to learn everything myself from point one.
And the hard way.
The hardest of ways. The hardest of ways. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe for some people it's a walk in the park. I don't know. Maybe some people get incredibly lucky, or maybe they're just much smarter than me. But for me, I seem to have to do it the really toughest way and learn every single skill from the bottom up.
Best people I know are exactly the same.
I don't know. It's very tough. It's very tough. You know, this whole entrepreneurism thing, I mean, I didn't own the title entrepreneur for at least 10 years. It just seemed ridiculous to me, because people saw entrepreneurs as being incredibly wealthy, successful individuals, with you know, fantastic ideas and tremendous lifestyles and so on. And I was constantly forgetting the toilet roll. Never had frigging toilet roll in our house ever. Ever. Milk was always sour. Fridge was always full of food that had just gone off. Children were always standing at the gate waiting for me to arrive. They were always competing with the phone in my ear, always. And it was incredibly, incredibly harrowing at times. You know, there were times. There was one in particular, and the bank had given us, 5 days, and I had to raise capital. I had to raise capital, or we were closing. And at this point, this was a bit later on. This was in 2012, 2011, and we were employing at this point about 35 or 40 people. So those 35 or 40 people were going to lose their jobs, let alone me lose mine. But I mean, you know, 35 or 40 people, 35 or 40 mortgages, 35 or 40 families. That becomes a hell of a responsibility, you know. And I was just, I felt at one and the same time completely broken, but totally determined. Do you know what I mean? All at the same time. And that conflict of emotion is exhausting. Do you know what I mean? Because when you're completely broken, you just want to run away. When you're completely fired up, you want to run too. Now you're completely schizophrenia in the extreme. And anyway, we did, I'll tell you about that later, but we did raise the capital, and we, you know, and we stayed alive, and we did that many times. It can be so hard. It's not for everybody. It's not for everybody. And you know, I said, I mean, right up until last year, when I eventually took on the, or this year in January, when I, well, last year, 29th of December, when I took on the American guys, right up to then, when people said, but you love what you do, don't you? And I would look at them going, yeah. Fuck. Do I? Yeah. I love it. I love it. I love being hogged to the bank. I love not owning my house. I love never having loo roll. I love I love it all, you know. And I think the bit that people don't talk about is the swan thing, you know. On the surface, you have to learn to have this calm exterior, but underneath, you are paddling like freaking crazy. Like crazy. It's a great skill to learn, but you have to accept that that's also a choice. And that where that leads you, you brought yourself there.
Yeah.
And so forgive yourself for it if it doesn't work out. Because the truth is that way more businesses fail than succeed. If success is you get out at the other end alive. And well, failure means that you don't, you know.
How would you measure success? Is success using that the money that you make from that to put a roof over your head? Is that a success or a success?
That's certainly a measure. So a measure of it is saying, you know, I was minded to say to somebody a while ago, you know, do you think I've done enough yet? Could I stop? Would that be okay, do you think? And but then, you know, an entrepreneur's never done enough, you know. So so that's one of the measurings of success. But I think that the other is a happy workforce. This is incredibly important. Building leaders, seeing young women in particular, we are like 90% women. So seeing young women develop into, you know, Boadiceas or Joan of Arcs or like really strong women. This is always exciting, tremendously, tremendously exciting.
But to me, that feels like a full-time role in and of itself, let alone being part of what you do. Identifying the women who can become Boadicea and Joan of Arc, but also
any woman
them.
Can become Boadicea or Joan of Arc.
Oh,
anybody Love can it. Be that. Anybody can be that. Anybody. Everybody can. But what you need is someone to believe in you. So many people have no one who believes in them. So many people have a voice in their head that does not believe in them. Your own voice doesn't believe you.
Mm.
If your own voice doesn't believe in you, you're fucked.
Mm.
So you have to change the way you think about yourself, and then you have to surround yourself with people who believe in you and what you can bring. Oh God, here we go.
Shit, sorry, tears well,
what
are coming.
What you can bring to the table, it's so important. My husband, bless him, has been through the freaking ringer with this business for 15 years. The ringer.
Mm.
He worked in the BBC, for God's sake. Most marshmallowy organisation. Love them. Love BBC. But the most marshmallowy organisation in the world. I worked there myself for a while, you know. Oh, my God. So wonderful. And marshmallowy and not real. And so, you know, he was just catapulted into this real world.
Mm.
Like, with a smack.
Mm.
But he somehow believed. When we had to hand over the house and became renters of our own home,
Mm.
he had to sign that document, and I had the flu. We'd been arguing for weeks. He wanted to pull down the shutters. He wanted to go and live in a council house. He wanted to stop seeing me in such pain and trauma and exhaustion and all of that. And I kept saying to him, I think this is our chance. I think I can see the future. I think I know what we can do. I really do see it. And I think this is our chance, and I think we have to do it now. And we had these arguments over and over and over again. And at the end, when he was actually signing the piece of paper, and you know, we got the guys round to value the house, and oh my God. And I had the flu, and I was lying. I literally couldn't get out of bed. And I was lying in bed, and my eyes were streaming. You know, my nose was streaming. My everything was just streaming. My ears, everything. I was so ill. And I'm sure that was partly stress, you know. I'd stressed myself into this hole. And Colin was standing at the end of the bed, and he had the piece of paper. And he said, I can't believe you're making me do this. And I said, well, I'm not making you do it. I think I can see what we can. And I was still flipping, arguing for it. Honestly, insane. I'm a crazy person, really. And he turned around. I remember it so clearly. And he had the piece of paper at the end of the bed. And he turned around to my dressing table, and he slapped it down, this big contract, and he signed it. And he said, "There, does that show you I believe in you?" And I thought, "Yeah." Now I'd better make a success of it, you know. And I fell asleep. Got up about 3 days later, and then
renewed.
Well, and then 4 weeks after that, the crash happened. That was in 2007. And 4 weeks after that, the crash happened, and we would not have got that mortgage. We wouldn't have had the money to fund the business. We would have been out in our ear because the business would have closed. We would have had no home to live in because we couldn't have been able to afford the mortgage that we had, the first one, and we'd have been screwed. So everything for a reason.
Mm.
So you would have thought, I am handing over my home. Am I freaking nuts? My father thought I was nuts. My husband thought I was nuts. My sister, God bless her, you know, the one who all those years before had said, stop doing this.
Mm.
I mean, she just thought I was insane. Everybody thought I was completely bonkers, which I probably was a little bit. But if we hadn't done that, 4 weeks later, we'd have lost everything. Everything. So isn't that amazing? So I know people say that they don't believe in everything for a reason, and that's bullshit. It's not bullshit. It's not.
Mm.
Look at it and learn from it.
That's the thing. It's don't just let it happen to you and look back wistfully and go, oh, that happened for a reason. It's like I was saying to you before we started recording, I was in a situation where it was like, on paper, I've got everything that I had manifested or worked for. Mm-hmm. Manifest is such a weird word. I don't know how I feel about it. But I'd worked for an opportunity, and it was awful.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, right, Emma, what are you supposed to learn from this? And I knew the lesson was walk away. It took me a while, but it was like, walk away. But as soon as I had that conversation with myself, it was like, this is what you've got to learn. Yes, you're worth this much. This is your value. But you have to, if it's not right, that's the lesson that you need to learn from this, clearly.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, because you should be happy otherwise.
Because mm-hmm.
you've
mm-hmm.
got everything on paper.
Yeah, everything looks good.
Mm.
Everything is working. So what's wrong?
Mm.
And it's I mean, those are huge salutary moments, because that's a choice of giving up.
Mm-hmm.
Something, you're giving up a lot of different things, but you're pursuing something much more important. Because I think, going back to what we said before, what's in your core is the most important thing in your life. And so many people don't understand that. Look after your core. I always say to girls, nobody ever died for the lack of a lipstick, a moisturizer, or a tan.
Mm.
Okay? Look to what's important, and what's important is in your head and in your heart. These are the important things. The peripheral things that we do, these are lovely, and they improve confidence, and it's nice to walk down the street and think, I'm wearing a nice lipstick, or I'm wearing a nice dress, and, you know, my skin looks good, or my hair is lovely, or blah, blah, blah. Or even, I'm wearing a tan. But that's peripheral. That confidence is the icing on the cake, but the cake needs to be made of proper confidence, and that is what's inside. It's what's in your head. It's what stories you tell yourself, the stories you tell others, the values that you live by. These are the most important. I should stop this. What am I saying? I sound like I'm this targe of a woman. But
do
it is
not
so important.
Stop.
These are the most important things in life. And don't give up your principles. Don't give up your principles.
I've talked about this before, so some listeners who've been with the show for a long time will know I didn't do that until my late 30s. Like, what do I actually stand for? And it was like that Zoolander moment. Who am I?
Yeah, yeah. And I've said so often when people say, oh, you're a business person, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I've always said, I don't define myself by my business. That's not the middle of who I am or who I want to be. And it's not the middle of what's important. So, you know, actually somebody said to me that until we merged, and we merged with, you know, different culture over on the other side, the other side of the pond, that they hadn't really realized what I meant whenever I kept saying, we need to be a joyful business. We need to positively discriminate for positive people.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have laughter. We need to have fun in the middle of our day. We need to live where we are working. It is this whole work-life balance thing. I think, okay, I'm probably overthinking it. I do tend to overthink things, but I think this was a construct made by men in the 60s. Okay, initially. Now it's become a thing of look after yourself. But if you look back to what it was, this was at a time when men, always men, worked. They went out to work and they came home to live.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And they had their living at home and then they had their working over there, and they separated those two things. Women can't do that, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Women mostly are very tied through their embodiment. They're very tied to others. They're very tied to their family. They're very tied to their children. They're very tied to other people and other things. The line between working and living has to be blurred.
Mm.
You have to live while you work. You spend at least, in my case, 16 hours, but at least 8 hours a day working. So you better learn how to live and enjoy it and have joy, which doesn't have to be joy about the work that you're doing, but just general joy in your life. Mm. It's really, really, really important for mental health, I think. It's one of the keys. Don't try to segregate and don't try to section off your life. Your the bits of you. You're one thing, including your head is inside this one thing that is you, that is embodied. You're real. You're all of a piece. Make it all work together. Don't split it all up. That way lies schizophrenia. It lies that difficulty of, I need to go this way and I need to go this way and I need to go two ways at the same time. Oh, my God. No, just have a laugh. Have a bit of fun. You know, I think productivity is way higher. This is to be very businessy about it. I think productivity is way higher when people are happy. And happy people tend to be joyful people.
And how do you make people happy in the workplace?
I don't make people happy. They make themselves happy. I can't make people happy, but I can give them the permission to be happy in work. So our girls in work, if anybody rings our office, they'll always hear a guffaw in the background. Ah! You know, happening over there while somebody's on the phone talking. And that's because they're maybe having a laugh, or they're having a conversation, or they're discussing a product, or they're trying something on, or, you know, we regularly do spray tans in our office. Everybody's always trying new product, and there's always some half-naked girl running around the place with a dressing gown on saying, isn't that lovely? Isn't it so beautiful? Oh, look, look, look. And, you know, I've had this on for 10 days. Did you know that? Because there's always a giggle happening. And I encourage that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't encourage too much craziness, and, you know, not too much. Mm-hmm. Not so that the person on the other end of the phone can't hear, but, you know, have that relaxation, that fun, and giving them permission to be like that. And again, we had occasion where we had someone from the other side over, and here was a comment. It was a guy. I think this is a very interesting way to run a business. When we go into work, we just work. That was the end of the sentence, and everybody just went. Really? But the girls, they go out together, they have fun together, they're a family, even of disparate girls, but they're all a family, and they stay a family. And people who leave the business tend to stay in touch, and people who move on tend to stay in touch with everybody. And and it's, I think that's about care. Do you know? So yeah, I can't make someone happy, but I can give them permission to be joyful.
So you said earlier about you're 100% in the things that you do. So when you just said, you know, his comment was, when we go to work, we just work. You're very determined and very focused.
Yeah.
So you're all about the work. So how does it become joyful for you so that you're still 100%?
Try not to take it too seriously. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a hard lesson for me to learn. Do you know what I take seriously? I take things like integrity really seriously, like just as seriously as possible. I mean, honesty, consistency, you know, fairness, these things. I take these things very, very seriously. I think because when I was a girl, I went to boarding school. So I grew up in Ireland, in Northern Ireland. And in 1972, the village next to ours was blown up, and my best friend was blown up in that bomb. She was only nine. She was eight, actually, and I was nine. And so within 2 months, that was happened in July, and by September, unbeknownst to me, I was being sent to boarding school. Didn't really know that I was going to, in those days, way back, and that's like 45 years ago, oh my God. You know, people didn't talk to you about these things. They didn't say, you know, I knew Catherine had died. I didn't really understand the concept of death so much. And I knew something about the big sound that I'd heard come billowing down the valley.
Oh my gosh.
Had something to do with, and then she was gone. Right. But I didn't really understand. I knew that my mum running up the, you know, running into the car and running up the road and coming back, and her beautiful suede boots, she was always very well dressed, and her beautiful suede boots were all dirty and muddy, I thought, and I couldn't understand why they were all muddy, and she looked so distressed, and I remember saying to her that your boots are all dirty, Mum, why are your boots dirty? And she said, before she thought what she was saying, she said, oh, that's blood.
Oh God.
She'd been standing in a pool of someone's blood in her suede boots in the middle of this mayhem. And then about 2 or 3 days later, they told me Catherine wouldn't be coming back. I couldn't see Catherine. And then sometime after that, they told me that she had, you know, she was dead. Mm. And I had to try to wrap my head. I didn't really understand. It took me a long time to understand what that was. Anyway, I went to boarding school and probably was a little bit depressed or confused or, you know, whatever. Didn't really want to leave home. My family were very, very frightened. We were getting a lot of bomb scares and things. So, you know, at our own home. My mother was just beside herself. And so I went to boarding school. And for the first 3 years solidly, I was bullied all the time. with people who, you know, one girl in particular, and she would 1 minute pretend to be my friend, the next minute she'd beat me about, the next minute she'd be nasty as hell, the next minute she'd get all the girls against me, and the next minute she'd be my friend again. And I learned after a while, I just never knew where I was with her. And and then there were, and, you know, other people would join. They were so in awe of this girl. She was a very strong character, obviously, that they all followed her. And so I could sometimes be in the gang, but mostly on the outside of the gang. And the things I learned there were, that I hated, were lying, deceit, two-facedness, all of those things. Dishonesty, lack of integrity. I didn't have all those big words, but I was just very lonely for 3 years and begged my parents to take me away, begged them to take me away. They were, of course, frightened that I would be nearer the trouble, so they didn't take me away, and I had to work out how to live with this thing. And I think subconsciously, and only the way that a 12-year-old can, I decided that I wouldn't live in that way anymore, that I would have integrity, honesty, that these things would follow me through my life. And so these are the things I take seriously. These are the things that really grind my core. And I get very stressed when I'm put in situations with people who are very loose with those things, who don't care. This makes me mad. Do you know what I mean? That I'm watching anybody else getting bullied. If I see anyone, I can't help it. I just have to go straight into the middle of it. It's desperate. Which I really, at 55, you'd think I would learn to stop that, wouldn't you?
Well, even if you're just out and about and you see it in the street.
I couldn't bear it. I have jumped into, particularly when I see kids bullying, you know, someone. Not small kids or even teenagers or whatever. You know, I should be careful of that in London, shouldn't I? they could have an implement of some kind. but I can't bear it. I can't bear it. And in the workplace, I can't bear it. I just can't bear it. I hate it. I hate it. And I have watched, we had one girl who was incredibly smart, incredibly talented, very funny, and a total bully. And she wasn't bullying me, but she was bullying the people around her. And I didn't notice at first, because it was all being done really cleverly. And then I noticed that these girls were really desperately unhappy. And once I knew that, once I was sure what she was doing, and once I recognized her for what it was, I had to let her go. And she was, at that point, probably our number one employee. But my observation was, after she had gone, within 24 hours, the team that she had bullied all lifted themselves up, and our productivity was better than it had been with one less person. It was better than it had been with that one person the day before. Like, it just literally lifted. The mood in the building lifted. She was just so negative. She just complained all the time. She wound people up. Nobody could do anything right. She would 1 minute make you laugh, and then the next minute tell you you're, you know, whatever. Awful. These mind games, this manipulation, and it was just horrific. And you know, massive, massive life lesson. Get rid of the negative out of your life. Positively choose for the positive, and good things will flow from that.
Yeah.
They really will. I mean, don't be naive about it, but good things will flow from good things.
It's very interesting. I don't know whether it's physics or quantum physics, maybe, but it is that thing of, I don't want to get into specifics necessarily, but having things in your life that you think give you safety or comfort or things that you should have. And then I definitely, in the last few years, walked away from relationships or what have you, and felt that immediate sense of loneliness and that horror of, oh my God, what have I done? Because I've done it now and it's irreparable. And then you realise that after a while, what you've done is you've opened a door to the stuff that you actually want / deserve.
Yeah, deserve. Yeah. There's a word for women. There's a word for women. Deserve.
Yeah.
You know, you do not deserve No one deserves to be bullied.
Mm.
No one deserves to be lied to.
Mm.
No one deserves to be treated candidly, and in a, not candidly isn't the right word, but in an offhand manner.
Mm.
No one deserves to be disrespected.
Mm.
No one deserves that. You do not deserve that. You do not deserve that. I'm looking at the orange mic and I'm going, you do not deserve that. You don't deserve it.
Yeah.
Don't. I watched my daughter in a very difficult relationship, very young woman in a very difficult relationship for a very long time. And what struck me, it was so amazing. She kept wanting to forget all of the difficult stuff that was happening to her when it was good for just a moment. Because she wanted to believe, it was a nice thing, she wanted to believe that the relationship is all about the good. And somehow our brain's a bit like childbirth, you know, your brain cuts off the memory of the excruciation experience, well, the excruciating experience.
Heard.
Well, yeah. No, what your brain does, like, cut it off so that you can't remember until you go back through it again. You think, what the hell? Why did I not? Why am I doing this again? And so your brain wants to cut all that off, all that badness off. And actually, sometimes you have to hold on to that badness and remember what that badness is so that you can avoid it in the future.
Mm.
You have to be honest with yourself. You know, it's not Hollywood. We don't live in fairy castles.
Mm.
You know, life is real.
Mm.
And you should also, you know, when you're positively picking for positive people, you should also positively pick for the positive you, for yourself. Pick the good things that are good for you, so long as they don't hurt anyone else.
Yeah,
go for it.
And it starts definitely, I think, with how you speak to yourself.
Oh, yeah, the voice inside. You know, I had the worst voice inside my head from having an alcoholic mother who became an alcoholic and the troubles, right? So after that bomb, right, she just spiraled downward. She couldn't cope. We all got out of Dungiven. She got stuck in it, and we were ostracized as a family, and nobody was allowed to speak. We were Protestants, Presbyterians, I said that bit already. And, you know, the local community were not allowed to speak with us. You would walk up the town and people would have to cross the road to not be seen talking to you and this things like that. It was a bizarre period of history. It broke my mother, totally broke her. But she wasn't a pleasant drinker, put it that way, you know. So that, a lot of bad voices got inside my head. And between that and the bullies at school, you know, that period between age 8 and age 13 or 12 was not a great period.
It's a lot to process.
A long time, yeah. And so I still had the voices inside my head. And all the way up through my 20s and my 30s. And, you know, I was in my 40s doing the business. And a hairdresser, a guy that I'd been going to for years, Mark, lovely, 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 lovely man. I still, every time I'm home in Belfast, I still go and get my hair done with him. And I was saying something about myself, whatever it was. Oh, I'm just old, fat and ugly, or something like that. And he stopped blow-drying my hair. And he said, Alison, I cannot listen to you say this about yourself anymore. It is not fair.
Mm.
It is not fair. You are a beautiful person. You are beautiful looking. You are a beautiful human being. Stop saying this to yourself. It's not healthy. It upsets me when you talk about yourself like this. And do you know what? I heard Claudia Winkleman say of herself, sure, I'm 46. What did she say? I'm 46 and I'm awful looking or something like that, or I look terrible, I'm like a drapey bag, I can't remember what she said, but it was something like that. And I was like, Claudia, don't say that about yourself. Don't. There are enough people in the world who are going to say horrible things to you. Do not say the horrible things to yourself. Look at yourself and say, what am I? I've got two arms and two legs, I'm healthy, I am a good person, I'm a lovely person, I'm great fun to be around. These are the good things. Start talking to yourself, like, actually stop yourself dead when you start to say, I don't say it anymore. I do say I've lived a very long life because I'm 55 and I have. But But I don't... And if I say I'm old, it's because I respect that.
Mm. It's a badge of honour as opposed to...
It's a badge of honour. But I don't say... You know, even though I am a bit overweight, I don't say I'm fat or I'm ugly or I'm whatever. I just refuse to let myself say those things anymore.
Yeah.
Because it upsets others and I'm not being fair to myself. And if I spend so much time being fair to other people, then I should sometimes be fair to myself too.
I also, in my experience, I used to talk like that, and it would almost be my opening gambit.
Absolutely. Because then you say it first, you see if it's your opening gambit, I got it in, now you don't have to say it to me.
Exactly.
Or think it of me.
But what I felt like it did, it was Alison's pouring water, we're not
sorry,
in the
bathroom.
Sorry,
no, water.
Not doing a pee.
So if I pour much more water...
Yeah, we'll have to take a break. But it used to be my opening gambit, and it would always be my... or this, and it would almost be the thing that I define myself by, whether it was, oh, yeah, I've got polycystic ovarian syndrome, so I had a moustache and acne as a teenager. And it would be, this is what's led to me being imperfect now, just so you understand.
Yeah.
But what I felt, and what really had to change, create a shift in me, was that it felt like I was doing it in order to make me feel more comfortable and almost to get a free pass from people, almost like a sympathy vote. But what has happened to me historically and why I broke the pattern was people used to saw the vulnerability, and I have one of those faces. I've got big eyes.
You do.
And if you wound me, you can see it immediately. Mm-hmm. So I'm like instant payoff bully target gold.
There you go. Totally. So I don't have big eyes, but I've got very expressive eyes, I've been told, and I do exactly the same thing. And it's not... It's right. It's not smart. And when you get old enough to understand that, then it's great to stop it. But it's also just not fair to yourself. You know, give yourself a break. Like, seriously?
No one's gonna do it for you.
That's the point. And the more that you do, the more people expect. You know, and sometimes you just have to step back and say, I am going to preserve me. You know, I still look back at this as one of the huge moments of my life, but I knew it was big, I just didn't know how big it would be. When I was at school. But my bully, this girl, who shall
you never forget them, do you?
Oh my God. Anyway, so it had been 3 years. She was tiny, actually. She was, and I was huge. So I was like 5'8". At that point, I was 12. I was 5'8", and very athletic, all the rest. And she was this little petite girl with beautiful, shimmering, bronzy blonde hair, naturally. Okay. Actually, I don't know if she was very, very beautiful, but she had this beautiful hair.
It's amazing. It's amazing how it feels in the moment. If you had a time machine and you went back, you'd think she just looks like any other schoolgirl. But
it's her power, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, on this particular moment, we were in the dorm, and for some reason that I can't remember, she was, as often she had me lying between two beds. And she was on top of me, banging my head on the floor. Okay, so she had my head, and she was banging it on the floor, and sitting on top of me doing this, right? And I was like, bang, bang, bang with my head, and I was thinking, I am really big. She is really small. Why am I letting this happen? And in that moment, I flicked her over. I banged her head. This is terrible, okay? But this is what I did. I banged her head 3 times on the floor. It had been 3 years. I'm just saying.
All right? One for each year.
And then just to polish it off, I took her ponytail, and I took her by the ponytail only, and took her from one end of the dorm, took her from between the beds, swung her around, took her from between the beds, up to one end of the dorm, and then dragged her to the other end of the dorm, lifted her just a little bit higher, and dropped her. I'd had enough, obviously. I'd broken, right? And what was really interesting was that So she ran out screaming and horrified that I had done that. And I sat on my bed alone in the dorm and I thought, well, I didn't say I'm screwed because I wouldn't have used that language. But I knew I am in for such a trucking now. I don't even know where to go. I don't even know if I should leave the dorm. Will it happen here in the dorm? Will it happen outside? What's going to happen? Something enormous is going to happen to me. And what did happen was that another girl who would have been like bully number two came in to me and said, Alison, did you say that you'd lost your hockey stick? And I looked at her and went, yes. I hated hockey, by the way, so I didn't really care. They're like, yes. She said, do you want to borrow mine? And I was like, yes, I'm not sure. Then another one came in and said, Alison, would you like a sweet? Another one came in and said, Alison, we're going to go for a walk round to the wood. Do you want to come with us? And I was like, these are the girls who had lied about me stealing something so that I went into sick bay for 3 weeks and was put into Coventry in school for 3 weeks. No one was allowed to speak to me, including the teachers. It was a bizarre school, now I look back on it. And of course, I hadn't stolen anything, so I couldn't say I had stolen it to get out of the sick bay. And then eventually the person who had stolen the stuff admitted what she'd done, and I was allowed out of sick bay. Not with an apology, by the way, just allowed to go back to the dorm where I was going to get bullied anyway. You know, whatever. I quite like the sick bay. It's quite quiet. It's quite good, actually. It's like, okay, nobody's saying anything bad to me. Nobody's saying anything to me, but they're not saying anything bad. So I was so confused, and it took a long time for me to realise. And then things started to calm down quite a bit. But and I started to do better at school because I wasn't so frightened all the time of what's going to happen next and everything else. But looking back in it, what I had done was stand up to the nemesis who everybody else didn't want either. But they just were too scared to do anything about it, so they'd rather join her than go against her, because they didn't, they saw what was happening to me, so therefore they didn't want that to happen to them. And I guess throughout my life I continue to have that same attitude towards bullies, which is, I'm never ever again going to have my head banged on the floor for 3 years between beds, blah blah blah. I'm not going to have that happen. And that can get me into some trouble with the bullies because they tend to be difficult people. But at least I get to keep my soul intact.
So if you're in a situation that you can control, do you just leave it straight away or get rid of the bully, whichever is the option that's easiest?
I just call it out. I just call it out. I call it out. I don't allow... one of the things as I've gotten older that I've always decided to do is to just be really straight. Really straight. Now, not everybody... Not everybody in the South likes that. And men find that quite difficult.
You have no idea how hard it is for me to not break into a Southern drawl right now.
Oh, gone, Emma.
I have always relied on the kindness of strangers. Honestly, I'm going to go home and watch The Client.
Oh, bless your heart. Do you know what that means? So if anybody from the southern states of America says to you, oh, bless your heart, you know what that means?
Screw you.
Fuck you. And whenever I first learned this, I went, it means what? What do you, oh my God, what do you say in response? You just say, oh, bless your heart right back. That's it.
Great.
Fuck you too.
That's amazing.
There's a cultural reference that I was so shocked when I learned that every person needs to know this. They need to understand the language.
It was so worth me indulging myself to get that nugget of information. So one thing I'm going to ask you is about being in business and the kind of attitude that one has to have in a female-dominated business or as a woman in business. How does a woman have to have masculine sensibilities?
What do you mean by masculine sensibilities?
In order to succeed. It's more of a masculine sensibility, I think, to be perceived to be a hard ass and to be able to compartmentalise.
A woman, like any person, needs to be strong and clear and focused. Any person needs to be that. That's not a male trait. That's just a trait.
So we need to stop calling it a male trait.
You need to stop calling that a male trait. Absolutely. Mm. Those are not boy things. Those are just successful person things.
Oh my God, that's my lovely thing.
But that's just important. That's just really important to see.
I nervously volleyed the masculine stuff over the net and you have just... smashed it right back at me in the best way possible.
I'm sorry.
No, that's what I wanted. I was like very tentatively like underarm serve. And you just smashed. That's perfect. It's not boy.
It's person.
Yeah. Successful person sensibilities.
Yeah. Look, successful people, whatever you want to do, you need to focus on what you're doing. You need to work very, 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 very hard. You need to be incredibly committed. You need to be straight. You need to get done what you need to get done, and you need to therefore prioritize. Mm-hmm. Prioritizing is the hardest thing. It's the hardest bit. Learning that trick of being able to be super flexible and then be able to reprioritize on a pin. Mm-hmm. This is what will allow a business to grow and grow and survive. Forget succeed. Mm-hmm. Just grow and survive. You need to be able to be super flexible on the one hand, while on the other hand, being incredibly driven and determined and willing to do what it takes and the amount of work that it takes to do it. If you're a 9-to-5 person and you like your 9-to-5 life and you want to, which is perfectly valid, by the way, it's a beautiful life, then, you know, if you find your job boring, enjoy the fact that while you have a boring job, you have every evening off and both days of the weekend. And love that bit of your life and find the way to have fun while you're in work. But if you want to succeed on a larger scale, whatever that means for you, those traits are very important for success, which is that driven determination, super flexible, and the ability to see the need to prioritize and the willingness to reprioritize. So you move the priorities up and down in any given day, in any given moment. You have to be able to move. You have to be able to think on multi-level. It's like multi-level chess. If you imagine 3D chess, that is the game I play every day. several things move in many ways all over the board. And you have to be willing to move with them.
Yes, it isn't spinning plates. I'm sorry, no. I'm binning that. It's not spinning plates, you're correct.
It's multi-level chess.
It's multi-level chess. Star Trek chess. That's exactly what it is.
Absolutely. 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 It's like living inside one of those massive games. You know the games that you see the kids play, you know, the computer games, and they're like multi-level. Blah, blah, blah. It's exactly like that in business. Exactly like that.
So the flexible part, being determined, having your focus. If someone's in your ear saying, that's not the right way to go, and actually they're right.
You have to be flexible enough to be able to let it go and move to the other thing. Absolutely. Someone said to me, I think it was my husband actually, said to me he'd read a guru saying that the most flexible person in the business is usually the person who leads the business. The person most willing to be flexible. Because that flexibility is what gets you to survive. And survival is about 99% of success. Honestly, it's so important to keep going, to keep being there. And and to not close yourself down. You know, at the times that when we were like at the knife edge, not the knife edge, the cliff edge. It's not the knife, is it? Yeah. The knife edge is something different. So when we were at the cliff edge, that few times, you know, I always said to my husband, I'm not closing the doors on myself. Someone else will have to close. I will go to the last moment, the last minute.
Mm.
And I learned from this, but I will go to the last minute. If the doors close, I didn't do it.
Right.
I'm not closing doors on those 44 mortgages. I'm not doing it.
Mm.
Somebody else, the bank, whatever, will have to come and do it for me. Because I'm not doing it. I'm not giving up.
And I'll still be on the phone hustling while they're putting the chains over the door.
Exactly. Looking for that moment. And if you do that, at least you're giving yourself the best chance. It may still not work. Forgive yourself for the fact that it didn't work. But praise yourself for the fact that you didn't give up.
Mm.
That, as my father said, don't give up. What was my father that used to say? Alison. Because I'd look so stressed sometimes. And he'd say, Alison, look, it's like this. You know you're in business when you've got a pain in your head and a pain in your gut at the same time. Now you know you're in business. Because that's the stress.
Yeah.
You know. But the flexibility of, you know, as my brother says, the bat that comes and hits you from the side every day in a different way, you know, it's about learning to duck that bat and move over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not be flattened by it. Learn from it. Move over there. Be willing to compromise. Be willing to change tack. Be willing to listen to people who might know more or better or just might have a better idea.
Mm.
Be willing to do all that.
You started out in the beauty industry with no contacts within the beauty industry, which even now makes me shudder.
Not even one. I used lipstick. So I knew that.
As far as I'm concerned, that makes you part of the family. But, you know, let's be honest, it's not as easy as that.
No.
How, you said that your father was your mentor, but at what point, okay, you start making friends in the beauty industry, you start making contacts. How valuable was that, the networking and the surrounding yourself with the people who could help you?
Okay, so I'll tell you something true. So, first of all, I come from Northern Ireland, so I wasn't in any networking network. Mm. Okay, so I lived in Ballyclare. Well, Parkgate, actually, which is just outside Ballyclare, which is just outside Belfast, which is just outside Britain. Okay?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Nowhere. So so if I wanted to network, I'd have had to get on a plane and come over here.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do that. And anyway, I have got, and I should say this in advance, I have a real problem with faces. I've got like face blindness. It's a thing.
I'm the same.
Have you?
I
oh
am
my God. It is terrifying.
Terrible.
It's terrifying. So I go into a room of people who I'm supposed to know. I'll know your voice, but I won't know your face and I won't remember your name, therefore. And it is terrifying. So I avoid networking events like the plague because I just am scared. And if I've met you 3 or 4 times, I will know your face. Mm. But like, honestly, Emma, I could meet you on the street in a different place tomorrow with your hair up or wearing a hat or something like that, and I will probably walk past you. Not if you said hello, I'll know your voice, obviously, but even spending 2 hours with you, I still, until I've seen you like from many different angles wearing many different clothes, I will not know who you are.
You know what Gwyneth Paltrow does to get over that, because
what
she's the same, and obviously she meets many, many people who all want to have this big emotional connection with her. Every time she sees somebody at an event who she may or may not have met before, she said, when was the last time we saw each other?
Oh,
and she
that's
shakes
very
hands.
Clever.
Very clever. When was the last time we...
I'll do that.
Yeah, because then you get them to put it into context.
But they still don't tell you their name.
Oh, that's why...
Sometimes I say I forgot, but mostly I just tell people... particularly people, if I have any connection with them, I say to them, I won't know you for a couple of times, but that's okay, but just don't judge me on it,
yeah.
Okay?
That's why everyone's called darling and babe in the media, let's face it. What it really means is they have no clue what your name is.
Who are you? Why? Why are we talking? And then some of them going, and what can I get from you, which I hate. New York's full of that.
Eesh.
Oh, it's full of that.
Very transactional. So yeah. The networking thing just wasn't...
So the networking thing wasn't my biggest thing. What was my biggest thing was building my team around me and making great products. So this was the team that I built together, you know, and we all kind of grew together and we all learned the skills together. And many of those girls who were with me then are still with me now, 10, 12, 13 years later. So that was important because they believed in me. And they really did. I mean, like, the reason that I ended up making tan, first I was making skin, then I was making colour, because I still hadn't learned clearly from the skin, like, you can't do anything without money, Alison. And then my assistant asked me, would I make tanning? And I was like, no, Cherith. I don't want to be rude, Cherith, but, like, you come in every day and you're either white or orange. and your knuckles, like, look like you know, like a monkey. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not good. I can't make that. Mm. And she said to me with her big blue eyes, maybe you could make it better. Could you make it better so that I don't go orange? Maybe I could just go brown. And, you know, it was that thing of she believed that I could do that. So I thought, well, I'll give it a go.
Let's have a look
and you know, go in the lab and fix it all. And when we did, then it sold out. So then we, and that's how we started. But that, like, took 4 years. So 4 years of trauma to get to a point where we actually started to make some money.
Yeah. Is there immediate?
And another 6 before we made profit.
Quite wow.
So 10 years before we made profit.
So if someone likes the term entrepreneur and would like people to refer to them as one, would you say there's no immediate payoff? And actually, because entrepreneur has taken on that kind of flimsy, no nutritional value meaning. But it looks fabulous from the outside. So would you say that if you are going down the business route, let's take the entrepreneurship down around out of it, we're talking about no immediate payoff. It's a hustle and it's a slog.
Oh, it's okay. So what is being in business? At the beginning and for a long time, as far as I can see, it is terrifying, highly stressful, very long hours, 7 days a week, 365 a year, genuinely, including Christmas in my case. It is disorganization at home while you're trying to be organized in work, or disorganization work while you're trying to be organized at home. It is missed everythings. It is a constant juggle. It is exhausting. It's humiliating at times. It's transformational to the soul. It is wonderful to watch the people around you grow. It is a tremendous rocket ride. It is at the one time the worst thing you could ever do to yourself and the best thing you could ever do for your personal growth. So it is all of those things at the same time. It is like a life. A brand is like a life. It's a living, breathing, heart-beating thing. And so everything that can go wrong in life goes wrong in business. It's not for the faint-hearted, it isn't. But there are lessons that can be learned from journeys like this that you can apply to a private life that will improve your own circumstances, I think, because you can apply that rigor. Be rigorous, be flexible, be tenacious, be determined. Be willing to work really, 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 really hard. Be all in. All in. If you want to do something well, get all in. What is it? Was it Malcolm Gladwell says 10,000 hours?
Yeah.
It's true. Get all in. On anything. It doesn't have to be business. But you also have to be willing. You'll be broke for a long time, likely. And you have to know that. And you have to know the risk. Or maybe you don't. And maybe some big benefactor will come in and just give you a wad of cash.
Well, those are the stories we always hear about.
Yes.
Let's face it.
But those are rare. Guys, those are rare. Really much more common is the you give it your all and it still doesn't work and somebody else still does pull down the shutters. But in the meantime, what you have learned, it's like I always say to women when they, you know, a woman who gets pregnant and didn't mean to get pregnant, right? And the kind of shock and awe and excitement and terror all at the same time in her face. And I always say, the women for me who before pregnancy and babies and after pregnancy and babies, the women who go through that cycle are always far, far better employees, far more interesting people after, because they have learned, they've gone through the pain, they've learned so much about themselves, they've learned it's not all about them. One of the biggest lessons of life, it's not all about you, me, anybody. We are connected in this universe. None of us are islands. Nobody is the center of the universe. Nobody. Not even Mr. Trump. Bless him. Nobody. I'm just looking at
my microphone. I know, I was about to say.
It's the same color as Donald Trump. I need to get let back into the States. I better be careful. But you know, that you will learn something from it. And even if it all goes tits up, you'll still learn something from it. Learn from these things and know that everything is for a reason. I really do believe that. That sounds so cheesy. But, you know, my son always says I'm the cheesiest person on the planet. Goes, oh God, Mom, seriously?
He's going to be listening to you through a very different filter. We've come to the end of our time together because you have to get a plane. Yes. I feel like I've literally only just tip of the iceberg with you, my friend. So will you come back soon?
Of course I will.
I'm sure the listeners...
It's been just lovely, Emma. It's been just lovely.
I honestly, this would be a 7-8 hour recording if time was unlimited. But this is the real world, isn't it?
This is the real world. I've got to go get a flight, surprisingly.
Thank you so much. Obviously, the links to everything to do with Alison will be in the show notes that you can find wherever you are streaming, downloading, and listening to this podcast. Alison, you're a flipping legend.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been absolutely lovely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alison. I shall, of course, be getting her back with some urgency. If you want to get in touch with me, it couldn't be easier. Email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com or slide into those DMs on social media. I'm at Emma Guns on Instagram and Twitter. And you can also join the private Facebook group for the Emma Gunn Show, Emma Gunn Show The Forum. The link to join will be in the show notes. If you never want to miss an episode, hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening. And if you enjoyed this show or you want to give some feedback, you can leave a 5-star review. That would be awesome. And write a couple of sentences about what you have been enjoying. Thank you already to the over 600 listeners who've already done that. You made my day every time I read those. Thank you again. I can't wait to bring you another brilliant guest next week. So take care and I will see you on the next one.